My goodness, we have a great panel today. It's as if we planned it. It is it's pretty impressive. We have a lot to discuss. We have a lot to talk about. There were some elections, key elections last night. We want to talk about that. We want to continue in our pre-coverage of the debate coming up. We believe somewhere around 10 o'clock there will be some Supreme Court decisions that will come from that building, and we will try to bring you up to date on that. We're not exactly sure. We never know. But there's some big decisions that are waiting to be released, so we'll keep our eye on that this morning. Let me introduce the group to you and remind you that you can be a part of our conversation at any time by simply writing to us. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Shout out to all those that are struggling with cancer. I lost a good friend this week, so stay strong and keep fighting.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Yes, I'll think about the... how that hideous disease has impacted so many of our lives and those either personally or those that we love. Also, we welcome the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin is in the house. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good, Joe. It's good to be back. It's been a few weeks, so I'm looking forward to getting into the conversation and seeing what the Supreme Court dumps on us.
Yes. you don't feel like you missed anything because it's just been fairly hideous. So, you're fine.
It's the beauty of Wednesdays.
Yeah, that's great. Absolutely. Yes. We'll see what happens. We also welcome the advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Anna Markowitz is with us. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I just would assume this is like your crazy busy time.
It's always pretty crazy busy. They always have some trip going out somewhere in America, but yeah.
They're always going somewhere. We also are...
kind of their job, right?
are pleased to welcome back Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I've missed everyone on the roundtable. I've been gone for like a month, but...
Where were you fun?
I was in Colombia.
Oh, nice.
Yes, it was a blast.
It was so much fun. And that was, for my memory, that was a pleasure trip, not a work trip.
100%.
Excellent.
I only read my emails as necessary.
Good.
I was very off grid. It was amazing.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Welcome back. And it's a great group. We have a lot to talk about this morning, as I mentioned, and we will get to it. Again, we remind you that you can be a part of the conversation, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Let us look at where we are as far as events, and we'll talk about the elections last night and how they... I don't know what we can glean from them. Who knows? But it is... I think it's interesting. Jamal Bowman lost with the left is on the defensive. Mr. Bowman's win in 2020 seemed to herald an ascendant progressive movement. In 2024, the center is regaining power. So that is one headline from yesterday's voting. Also, a very crowded primary in Colorado. Lauren Boebert. Remember her? Mm. she left her district and moved. She swapped districts, which I didn't know you could easily do, but apparently she did it. And, you know, you go to the theater once, it turns out badly, and you have to change congressional districts. But that's what happened. So the victory by the MAGA lawmaker in the conservative eastern part of the state put her on track to another term in the House, after she abandoned a more politically competitive district, and she was nearly guarantees that she will that she will beat the Democrat in the fall. But so that is another headline to come out of the voting yesterday. And I think I'll keep it there. There are other stories that came out of voting, but one of them really about the New York State Assembly primaries, where incumbency outweighed political differences, which I think is also an interesting plot line as well. All right, let's start to my left. Bob, go ahead.
Bobert, and the evil wraith comes back, and in that was a Beetlejuice reference to people at home.
Yes. So that's just,
a couple things. The I would be cautious about reading too much into the Latimer Bowman election, saying progressives on the run. I think Bowman was guilty of some really heinous self-inflicted wounds. That had an impact in the district. I also think the Latimer election, that was really interesting because it does sort of harken back to O'Neill's position about, all politics are local. And one of the things you can't ignore is Latimer's deep ties to the district at almost a sub-local level, which I thought was pretty interesting. I also, be honest, Joe, I don't understand the Colorado voters. I mean, they've seen the bad behavior from this individual, and had an opportunity to send a message about what and who they wanted to represent them, and I'm just disappointed in the voters.
I mean, it was again a crowded field. They had choices.
They had choices. And again, it becomes much more about the theater than I think it does about really good politics. I mean, there's a person here who has demonstrated an inability to get anything done in D.C. and in fact, has missed key votes because she was screwing around and. I think the only way we get beyond this really sour period in our political history is by cleaning out people like her, and frankly, I think Bowman. One other election I do want to put on the table for the panel, and then I'll stop. The Utah Senate election I thought was really interesting, where I thought the more moderate, more the Mitt Romney candidate was nominated by the party, which in Utah means that it most likely will be, unless something catastrophic happens and the asteroid hits, will be elected. So that's another one of the races that I'd like to put on the table.
John Curtis. Vera.
Well, for me, I have to say, Bobert just confirms once again that the behavior on the very top by Trump is equally awful as her behavior, and that's what the hard right likes and wants: a disruptor, not somebody who's effective, not somebody who's a coalition builder, but they want somebody to just explode and shame and just sort of disrupt the entire system to create something different, but they don't know what it is, and they just want to destroy rather than build. So for me, this is a very negative sign, especially that part of Colorado is truly mysterious to me as well, I would say. So I don't know, Anna might have something more to say about that place, or Nick, but it's just a scary place, I have to say. I could not feel comfortable even walking around some of those districts.
Well, interestingly, I lived in Colorado and was a whitewater raft guide in southern Colorado for 2 years, and I was a teacher for those 2 years. But I also was a ledge aide to a member of the House of Representatives in the Colorado legislature. So weirdly, I do actually am familiar with this part of the country. And I will say that the politics are really incredibly interesting, having come from politics in New York and being familiar with politics on both coasts, and just being in the center of the country. It was eye opening. Her new district particularly is the sort of center of evangelical life in the state and in this country. It's one of the most evangelical centers in the country. And that part of the lower section of the city of Denver has an extremely high proportion of Hispanic and Mexican immigrants, you know, of many generations, but a lot of recent arrivals as well. And so there's a lot of really interesting nuances in those particular communities and what that looks like for her on the ground. I'll just say that.
Nick, how does her position in action appeal to the evangelical voter? I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
I think, you know, when you separate the performance and you look at the underlying intention of the, you know, conservative, the ultra-right politics, people are actually pretty skilled at compartmentalizing, and they can separate the theatrics from the underlying goals that they believe that she represents, which is this sort of, far-right, ultra-Christian sort of nationalist identity. And I think at the local level, she is able to articulate that to voters in smaller spaces.
So personal behavior doesn't matter. It's just that you mean by compartmentalized. So her behavior of
her screwing around in a theater,
yeah, that doesn't matter. Heckling Biden, that's just like considered, you know, proper conduct, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think essentially it doesn't matter. I think what matters is that she'll vote the way they want her to vote, and they'll support these ultra-conservative initiatives that they want her to support, mm-hmm. and they'll, like, kind of hold their nose at the theatrics, and they'll say, that's not her, the real her. The real her is that she will combat the left's, you know, LGBT agenda and, you know, these other, like, kind of...
Yeah.
You know, hyper-politicized agendas, right?
So I always think of them as value voters without values.
I mean, they have values, right? They're anti-abortion, they're anti-transgender protections, they're anti-LGBT equality. They have values, and they vote their values notwithstanding the theatrics of the person who's going to bring them. Mm. It's the same with voters, you know, ultra-conservative voters for Trump, right? He's clearly not, you know, a religious person, but evangelicals will back him anyway.
It's like values with vaping.
Yeah.
Anna.
I think what I took away from this primary season is, like, know your district. And especially, I've lived in Westchester and I've lived in Ulster County, and I think that they had two very similar races. One where a very progressive incumbent in Westchester, Bowman, was running against a more moderate, Jewish-friendly candidate. And they had very different outcomes. In Westchester, which is a more moderate community, it is a community that is higher income. It's a community that is predominantly white. And they elected someone who represents them and also who is a proven person with a track record. He also, in some ways, could be considered an incumbent because he is county executive and he's been involved at every level of politics for years. He came to my block party when I lived in Westchester. He was everywhere all the time, and it paid off. Also in Ulster County, we had the opposite results. We had Sarahana Sretha, that is the incumbent, who is a DSA candidate, and she won against someone who is a bit more moderate, more of a kind of she worked for Gabby Madden. She worked for Scoofish. She worked for Kevin Cahill. She's kind of been in the Democrat circles for years. And it turns out that in Ulster County, which is an extremely progressive place where people are excited to have people speaking kind of against the Democratic machine, that was a feature, not a bug. And so that worked for her. And so I think that we saw that kind of across the nation. We saw that with Boebert. She picked a district that worked for her, right? And So I think that that's kind of what we're seeing across the nation. It's not necessarily one national message that will work everywhere. It is, are you picking the right message that will work for your community?
Let's take a quick break and we'll continue the conversation when we come back. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm sure you may have a couple things on your mind. Feel free to share them with us. Panel at WAMC.org. We've got a great group, Vera Karius-Kelly, Bob Griffin, Anna Markowitz, and Nick Rangel on the show today. We'll continue our conversation after this news break from the BBC. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we've been talking about some of the primary voting that took place yesterday across the country, much of it taking place here in New York State. I wanted to just grab on to a snippet of what Bob said of what we can't read too much into, and you were talking about the Jamal Bowman race. But I would think to me anyway, it's safe to say that I don't think we can read a whole bunch into any of these races.
No, and you know, the feeling I have is I feel like I'm the frog in the beaker, and that the heat is on as we build to November. So this actually is almost somewhat meaningless to what we know is heading our way.
You're a fetching frog in the beaker.
I still don't know how to get out, and and I think it's getting hotter.
Yeah, but it's. Would you all agree that it's hard to think to take too much out of it as to where we're headed? I mean, I think that the narrative that was in that little squib that I read from the Times about Jamal Bowman, that people are moving. The progressive left wing is now coming a bit more centrist, but again, as you indicated, that seems to have more to do with the candidate than the ideals.
I think so. I think it has as much to do with some behavior that really turned people off. I think if the Cori Bush election goes differently, then you could argue that there may be some interesting points, but I'm not seeing anything that would indicate that.
Well, Vera and I are like making eyes at each other because I think what's the most telling, I guess, tidbit or like data point from the Latimer race, who, by the way, I know very well because he worked in the Senate. He was a senator. He worked in the Senate. He was a senator when I worked in the Senate, and he's a really, really great guy. And I think we want to not diminish like what an institution George Latimer is. That it's not, you know, somebody up and coming took the lead over an incumbent. George Latimer sort of is an incumbent, and decided to, you know, kind of take the reins at this particular moment, and largely because of the extreme level of funding that was poured, not even just into Latimer's race, but against Bowman's race, right? And it is, I think the focal point there is the changing conversation around American and Israeli relations, and how AIPAC is like sort of responding or reacting to the narrative around the war in Gaza. And that's, I think Vera has lots to say about that.
I mean, I was thinking, we were looking at each other because we were thinking immediately of AIPAC money, because there was enormous amounts of money spent on defeating anybody who was like, you know, like Bowen, who was extremely critical of Israel, described as anti-Semitic behavior and critique of foreign policy, and that was what really mobilized some of the Jewish voters, especially those that are very concerned about the future of Israel and U.S.-Israeli relations.
Yeah, but I don't think AIPAC was spending money anywhere that there was that narrative. They targeted this particular race because Latimer was such a strong candidate, because he is like an institution in that region, right? Like he is such a, he's wildly popular. He's well-liked. He's a really likable guy. He has a great success track record. He's got a great resume. So like they
but
targeted
this. But he's also centrist when it comes to, you know, typical sort of standard expected U.S.-Israeli relations. And I think the wording, the critique that came from Jamal
from
Bowman,
Bowman
was considered extreme by a lot of people who were more supportive of the narrative of Israel defending itself against a vicious attacker, and they wanted to have consistency in U.S.-Israeli relations. And I think that is underlying some of this sort of electoral outcome.
Yeah, it's kind of the visual representation of the switch or shift in generational support of Israel that, all the research is showing that, like, younger generations just don't have the same mindset around American, Jewish, and Israeli relations. Yeah. And Latimer is the generation that is really still associated with that kind of connection and relationship. And it just is, like, this visual, like, that one and that one.
So, and Westchester is also very representative of Latimer's generation. It is an older community. There's a large Jewish population. And there was $25 million. It's pretty hard to know how representative that is of the rest of the country.
So with that, with the words, it's hard to know, let me ask you the question. I mean, 2 years ago, we made a big deal, the media, made a big deal in that of seeing many of those districts in southern New York, north of New York City, and going Republican. So now that we have the primaries, we have our candidates, how do you see that being something that the Democrats can turn around?
I don't think we have to worry about Westchester going to Republicans anytime soon. I think Rob Astorino was kind of a anomaly. It was a off year that he was elected. I think Latimer came in and was the perfect candidate to replace him. And I don't think that they'll ever go Republican again, but I do think that they are more moderate Democrats. They're a little bit more fiscally conservative. Mm-hmm. They have the highest taxes in the country to pay.
I think on social issues, things like abortion protection and LGBT protections, Westchester, as much as it's conservative on like some fiscal areas, they're fiercely protective of civil rights in that sense. And so I think that is like a real core voter block that would never vote Republican because of the Republican stance on those really core values.
So my question is in terms of the age groups that will vote, right? So I think in Westchester and places like that, we find mostly, you know, people in their 30s to mid-70s maybe voting, whereas younger voters, I find, generally are less inclined to support somebody like Latimer. And I don't know if that's the same case in Westchester, potentially. They are motivated maybe by protecting, LGBTQ rights and women's rights, but I'm not hearing that they're mobilized, excited, interested in,
No one's mobilized by local elections, but they will. Younger voters
will be mobilized
around presidential
elections.
Yeah,
you think you will? Because I don't hear anything.
But Vera, you're onto something excitement. I think that's really important because if you think about Latimer, he's in his 70s.
Yes.
Bowman's in his 40s. Yes. You know, the sort of the complaint about
Biden.
Both Biden and Trump is, you know, I can't believe we don't have younger candidates. Well, this is a situation where you had a younger candidate.
Right.
The other thing, too, and I fault the state for this, it's a god-awful time to have an election, especially a local election. If you're going to design an election that the least number of people would turn out. I mean, all you had to do is wait 1 week and do it the day before, you know, the day before the 4th of July.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, schools are out.
Yeah.
The K-12 are out.
Everything.
Graduation is over. I mean, it almost is perfect timing to make it as hard as possible for people to want to get out to vote. So I think that also plays in into
summer
this.
Mode. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, some of the participation rates were dismal in this. You know, so it doesn't really reflect
20,
necessarily,
22%
right?
In some cases, yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that's always shocking as somebody coming from a country where people actually feel compelled to vote and participate and engage. You know, we always get over 50% at minimum.
Rub our nose
but,
in it.
You know, once
Sounds
in a while,
like
I got to do that.
Brag over there.
Just, you know, a little bit.
You know, in Germany, where we actually vote,
not always well, but you know,
but you vote. That's right. I just want to quickly mention John Avalon too.
Oh yeah,
You know the who is he's a journalist for CNN. He he always did a feature on he did a reality check, and I always really enjoyed it because it was truthful. It was interesting. It was also just snarky enough that made it entertaining.
Yeah.
And so he won last night in Long Island, and so that'll be interesting to see where that goes.
But he's also more centrist.
Much more
centrist. You have to be on Long Island.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have to. But I mean, in general, he always has been. You know, a little more. He's not. I mean, he's critical. He's on the left, but center left. You know, he's not so.
You couldn't
succeed.
One else would have.
Good point.
Yeah.
So I mean, he has a he has his Republican incumbent opponent, who has only been in, I believe, for 2 years. So you know, we'll see where that leads us as well. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get ready and we'll talk about the debate.
Oh, Lord.
Debate prep 2024.
Oh,
we'll talk about that, and that'll bring us up to the top of the hour, and we'll expect in the 10 o'clock hour, I think, we'll get some Supreme Court decisions coming out as well. All that and much more. We welcome you. We know you have things to say. Panel at WAMC.org if you want to share them. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Great group, and we thank you all for being with us. And let's see, we have, I think we have a couple letters that I want to get to. One from Steve, who says, Bowman lost because the Democrats admitted they made a mistake with him. Boebert won because the GOP doubles down on a mistake. Maybe.
That's an interesting point. I had thought about it and discounted that because it sort of felt like it was too congratulatory, and there's just not enough data points to be able to point to that as a trend. But certainly when you compare those two races, I could see that I could understand the position the letter writer's taking.
Anybody else? Okay. Let's go to Kyle, who says the eastern part of the state is very rural and red. Not a surprise that they voted for her. This is Colorado, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Very unfortunate for our state and for our country. That from Kyle. All right, let's move on.
Joe, but still, could I just one thing about Kyle's letter,
yes,
real quick?
Of course.
It still strikes me though, is that, I mean, she was a carpetbagger. You know, I mean, she came with all of this baggage, but she wasn't even part of the district. And here we're talking about Latimer and you know, the deep ties. And it was so interesting to read about, you know, the fact that people in the district know that when he shows up with cookies. And, I mean, it's a small thing, but it's one of those things that sort of touches you to the folks that live there and says, you know, he's our person. And what connection does she
Bakery
have
bribe.
With that? I'm sorry?
Bakery bread.
Hey, listen, it works all the time, right? No. but it's also...
Women's been doing it for a year.
You know, My grandma's always said to me, if you show up to somebody to somebody's place without something in your hands, that you don't show up with empty hands. But she was just shopping around to keep the power, and it's like,
yeah.
That's bad.
I think that just sort of underestimates the influence of like a statewide GOP committee, because I don't think there's any universe where she moved districts without kind of the blessing of her party. And the party still backed her in that race, right? They wanted her to stay in office, and they moved her to a district that she was going to have less of a challenge winning.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better that the rot in the system goes up even higher than just her then.
Well, and we see that in New York,
fair,
too.
Fair boy, Bob.
Mark Molinaro couldn't vote for himself in the last election. So, you know, it's not like it doesn't happen everywhere.
And we know, I mean, you know, lines change and voter blocks change, neighborhoods change. And I don't think it's a new trick that Boebert played.
Colin says, cleaning out people like Bowman. Why would we, quote, clean out reps who are literally against Israel's ethnic cleansing and genocide of innocent Palestinians? It seems like the panel was going more right wing lately.
No, I'm thinking about behavior that I just think is really questionable, like the idea of pulling a fire alarm in order to disrupt a process.
Yeah. I mean, that really cost him. I think he just lost credibility right there.
Yeah, and the position he took on the sexual assaults after the attack also is another thing that I would point to say that I really have no confidence in him. At the same time, I've been more and more impressed with AOC and watching her develop more as a stateswoman. Mm-hmm. I felt that he was actually deteriorating as sort of a voice in Congress.
As a candidate, he was also not very visible in his district. He was invited to multiple events. He did not show up. He did not present himself to various groups. I mean, you engage with community, you meet people, you discuss, you're constantly on the road trying to connect with business people, with community members, with nonprofits, and he didn't do any of that hard work on the ground.
I think something I've just sort of witnessed being in the field for a long time is there are two kinds of sort of outsiders who come into politics and get elected, and particularly so because I was involved with more of the progressive left wing of those, you know, groups. An outsider, somebody who was not really involved in politics before they got into politics, they win an election and they either do what AOC has done, which is learn how to politic, or not. And the people who don't really learn once they get into politics how to do the politicking, the, you know, connecting with the voters and being present, being visible, moderating the tone, the responsiveness, holding back until they have a message that they are confident in. It's a real skill, and you see it with AOC, and I don't know that we saw it as much with Bowman, or maybe he didn't have as much time. And there was this moment that like kind of sparked some bad choices that brought him down more quickly. But, you know, the politicking for an outsider coming into politics is a real art, and it's hard to master, I think.
All right, let's go to John. And suddenly we have a lot of letters, so we're going to get to these to the top of the probably to the top of the hour. John says, squad schmod. Jamal Bowman has two things to blame for his crushing loss in the 16th district primary: his mouth, pulling the fire alarm in the rotunda of the Capitol on camera, only storing classified documents next to the toilet roll is dumber. His buffoonery has been well rewarded. Let's hope the voters are getting tired of polarization steering us into the third world. May moderation and compromise prevail. That is a letter that is a bit of an antidote to the letter that we got from Anonymous, who says, "Dear well-informed and active panelists."
Watch out.
Aren't you tired of the mess? I don't have any tea leaves or crystal ball, but I can tell you I am so sick of how politics has changed so much. I'm tired and I'm scared. I'm 73 years old. I'm an independent voter and done something I never thought was possible. I've turned off the noise on TV and stream movies. Breaking news is broken. I will, yes, reluctantly vote for Biden because the alternative is a serious disaster. Where, oh, where are the statesmen and stateswomen? We need them right now.
Yes.
Well, I think a lot of us would agree with what you just stated. The thing is, a lot of people will try to vote for disruptors, too. So we have to stay alert. We cannot just sort of hide, you know. I mean, some of us can, but some others, like many of us, pay close attention to what is happening, and we want to fight back, you know. We want to make sure we get on the right, on a better path. And I can understand why people don't want to be in politics. You have to be an exceptionally strong person. You have to be determined, and it's often ugly for your family. Even on local politics, you get viciously attacked or threatened. You get nasty letters. I mean, even some of us on this panel have gotten some really nasty letters, I must say. And it's not fun, but you push through and you push back and you pursue what your ideals are.
Or you have to be a narcissist. And well, yeah. Let's be honest. There's you know, politics, especially, it seems the lower house has become the political equivalent of the World Wrestling Federation, where it's all about theater, and it appears to be more scripted. And you know, the other thing we didn't talk about with Bowman is that, you know, he also voted against the infrastructure bill. There are lots of issues with him, but you know, as far as the letter writer is concerned, your feelings are, I think, shared generally. The question and concern I have is, what does that mean for the November election? Because that's the big one. And if people are going to decide that it's not worth it and they're going to stay home, then it's going to be a tough race.
Jonathan writes, one of your panelists, my apologies, don't know who it was, used the phrase Jewish friendly to describe Latimer, implying Bowman is not Jewish friendly. He is certainly, from my slim understanding, anti-Zionist, but in no way Jewish unfriendly. That from Jonathan. We then go to Roger on Warren. Is this Boebert? I think this is about the Boebert race. Yes. From Roger, this is a classical case of multiple candidates. An incumbent had by far best name recognition. If it were an open primary and ranked choice voting, such extremists would not be elected. Also, this on Boebert from John, this actually reduces the Republican representation in Colorado by one, because her old seat will go to a Democrat. Do we know that?
No.
Yeah, I don't think.
No. Her old seat, the election, in the Democrats, they were trying to push the more extreme MAGA candidate, and that didn't happen. That Republican nominee is the more moderate.
Yes.
So I think it's going to be a hard flip.
It's going to be, the fear is going to stay Republican, right?
Let's see. We go to Judith, who says, to leave out the $24 million spent in the Bowman-Latimer race is to miss the point, which is that elections can be purchased. There was not a time that I turned on the TV that there was not a scurrilous ad against Bowman. It was disgusting. Boebert had two opponents, which split the vote. Not such a great victory.
Yeah, Citizens United really showed in that election. Yeah.
Okay, and then finally, I just want to take a moment on this one. Stacy said, so you're located on Central Avenue in Albany, yet you don't find the Albany County DA primary result worth mentioning? A five-term incumbent loss, but you're talking about Long Island? It appears to be based on your obvious bias towards your commentator, David Soares. Well, bunch of things. first of all is that we have covered that race extensively in the news, and it has been all over. I think when we look at the panel, we cover seven states, and Albany County is just but one county of the huge region that we do, and it is a district attorney's race, which, again, we are covering. I do not think we were. I was going to mention it later on, but I don't know what you say. I think it has been covered, and it has obviously we've talked a couple weeks ago. We talked about some of the real issues in this campaign. Our obvious bias toward a commentator. I would also point out that Libby Post was running the campaign of the guy who beat David Soares. So yeah. I think we've got both of our bases covered on that one. And so I don't know what more you want to say. I don't think there's a bias. I think nor do I think that we're not. I think we try to. We're looking at races that have the most heft, and I'm certainly not downplaying that of the Albany district attorney, and yet I do think that sometimes there's bigger fish to fry.
Really quickly, and I don't want to hear the radios turning off, there was also some really interesting trends in the family court election. If we want to get into really sub-local, you know, there are some women who are elected, I think, have some really great skills to bring to public service. But I'm not sure people really want to listen to about public court.
No.
Family court.
I'm friends with all three of those women, and I'm really proud of them. But I was like, well, what is there to say? Great work. I love them.
Yeah.
So there's lots to say. I have more questions than answers about the DA race. And because of the nature of the race, there wasn't a lot of clarity about, like, where we're going in the future. And so
right.
I don't even...
You're voting against somebody, not for something.
Yeah.
I think there was some sense of that, although, I mean, you know, Lee's popular and he's, you know, well-respected and he's very, very successful and he's really good at his work. And I'm friends with his mom. So, you know, but because we don't really have a lot of information about where his stance is on some of those, like, key issues yet, it's hard to know where we're going, right? And it's like, what is there to talk about other than it is a really interesting race? I think Churchill covered it this week, actually.
It is an interesting race, and again, we have covered it on the news extensively. So, and which we'll continue to do because it's not over. He still has Kinlan still has a Republican opponent, which I know what that means in Albany, but still. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have much more to discuss. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Vericarious, Kelly, Bob Griffin, Anna Markowitz, and Nick Rangel with us on this Wednesday morning. As we mentioned, the Supreme Court expected to release one or two or three, we don't know, how many decisions they will release. The big ones that we're waiting for, of course, are the decisions on Trump immunity, abortion, as well as federal regulation. So so far, as of 10:05 this morning, the only decision that has been released by the Supreme Court coming out about 2 minutes ago is the Supreme Court has rejected conservative challenge to Biden administration's contacts with social media companies. In their first decision of the day, the Supreme Court's liberals and some conservatives banded together to reject a challenge brought by Republican-led states to efforts by the Biden administration to work with social media companies in combating misinformation over the coronavirus. So that is one case. I wouldn't call it the blockbuster.
Yeah, let me put it a different way, Joe. They released the results of a case that we really weren't as interested in as the immunity, which they seem to be holding on to really tightly.
Well, it's a little appetizer, a little soupçon.
it's a little amuse-bouche.
Yes, right, exactly. Just giving you a little taste of what's to come, I think.
Which I fear is going to be a rancid Sunday.
Oh, boy.
The plaintiffs in the Murthy versus Missouri case argue the White House request to take down coronavirus misinformation violated the First Amendment. So that is the first the first case that we have a ruling on so far. And again, we will update this. We'll be watching this as we continue our conversation this morning, unless the wonderful panelists before me have a lot to talk about in regarding to social media companies. We can move on to other stuff. All right, excellent. And then I will interrupt when we, if and when we get other cases that are interesting to talk about. Okay, let us go to what else is happening. And I think certainly we're at certainly we have a lot to talk about. Vera, I picked this story for you.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Now here we go. Kenya? Is that
yes, Kenya. Oh, okay. That's exactly where I'm headed. Anti-tax riots rock Kenya as the president vows a crackdown on, quote, treasonous protesters. At least five people were killed in clashes with police that erupted after lawmakers approved the tax increases. I was watching an in-depth story on PBS on this last night. It is a fairly tumultuous time in Kenya.
Well, I think it's tumultuous for a large part of Africa, actually. We have a lot of, you know, in Kenya's neighborhood, it's not exactly calm and quiet. In the north, we have the Sudanese crisis. In the east, we have the, Islamic fundamentalist threat and pirates in Somalia. In a little bit more of the west, we have the Congo, which has a horrific, internal war. So Kenya was considered one of the remaining allies to the United States. And the president of Kenya was just recently in D.C. meeting with Biden, and they had a bit of a large ceremonies to sort of confirm their friendship and their support. And the Kenyans had just sent their troops to Haiti, mostly paid by the U.S. to help with, calming down the situation in Haiti. And here we have the explosion inside Kenya. It's not entirely surprising. We have a lot of refugee camps in Kenya. There's a lot of poverty. Prices have been rising. And the Kenyan government is not known to be above spending enormous amounts of money on themselves. So there is a disruption between who's leading and who is, the population in the country. And we find sectors of all kinds of members in Kenyan society that are opposed to this tax increase because it affects mostly imports in terms of basic food staples and supplies. And this is something that people are saying, enough is enough. Our government spends a lot of money on itself. They do great performances internationally. They are, liked by the United States, but what about us? And I think that is how it exploded. The question about what about us as the people of Kenya that need our government to make decisions on behalf of our economic needs. And this is, clearly also important to consider are the behavior of Kenyan security forces. They're very aggressive. They are cracking down immediately, and they have, a stake in the system. So we will see ongoing protests in the country among young people, among elderly, among different tribal groups, among different sectors of society. So it was a fairly stable, fairly well-off African country where the middle class has had enough. And the middle class was growing in Kenya, and now they simply are saying enough is enough. We need a government that represents us and not international interests or their own interests.
Anybody else? Bob?
Yeah, I mean, one point that you didn't talk about, though, I think is important is the pattern of coups in Africa, particularly in that region, that are supported, funded by Russia, and that was as I was sort of looking at what was going on, I'm really interested to see because, again, if you look at what has been happening to U.S. interests in the region,
they've shrunk.
They have shrunk considerably.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where there's enough Russian military assets in some of these areas where the Ukrainians actually have special forces in attacking them. So, I mean,
So it's the Russians and the Chinese that are in economically making offers, bringing in their own labor, though. The Russians mostly their own military, the Chinese their own labor. And, you know, the French have also gotten slapped multiple times in Africa. They're pulling out of various countries. So it's the Europeans, the former colonial powers, and the Americans that are losing in Africa in terms of building relationships and establishing strongholds. And the Russians in terms of gaining in terms of military might, and the Chinese in terms of economic investments and interests. So it is a changing environment in all of Africa. And I agree with you. This is a fundamental concern for us, or should be, because we see the growth of Islamic fundamentalist groups. We see the growth of terrorism. And Kenya is just one of the pieces in that larger puzzle, as you said.
Anybody else? All right.
That's pretty thorough.
Pretty thorough. Kudos. All right. I want to go back. I was waiting for we're still kind of eyeing what the Supreme Court is up to, and as of now, it's just the one decision that has been released. So I was waiting a second to get into talk about the debate that takes place tomorrow. Mm. let's see. We got a letter in anticipation of our conversation from Matt, who said the whole Biden on performance-enhancing drugs nonsense is such a predictable Trump gambit. It is right out of the calling the election rigged before the election takes place playbook. They are saying this so they will have a built-in excuse should Trump get his hat handed to him during the debate, which is a distinct possibility. And conversely, if Trump somehow outperforms Biden, he can tout how great a debater he is. That is one letter that we received on that. Meanwhile, both sides are working on debate prep. It seems like one side, that of current president Joe Biden, is working a little more diligently and orderly as to have sessions at Camp David and working on the intricacies of each issue that could come up in the context of the debate. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign continues. There are some what they say in the moment discussions that are taking place in regards.
Joe, when you're a stable genius, you can do that.
That's right. You can have these in the moment conversations, and those seem to be working. And then, of course, he's out on the campaign trail, and he feels that working an audience and dealing with people is beneficial and will help them. Even though we should note there is no audience for this particular debate. So that is that's of interest as well. I will say I just received an email. So just so if you know where this is headed, stop me if you've heard this one before. This is the message I got from Donald Trump. The gloves are coming off. I'm bringing out the big guns before I step into the ring with crooked Joe Biden. Sleepy Joe is relying on a cocktail of drugs to keep him upright and awake. He's relying on highly biased moderators like Fake Tapper to feed him softball questions, and he's relying on his army of so-called fact-checkers to spread lie after lie on his behalf. But I don't need any of that because I'm putting my faith in you, friend. And then you press the button and it says advise Trump, and you advise him by giving money.
No,
Joe, don't do it. As tempted as you are, Joe, don't do it.
Unsubscribe. What list are you on? I did not get that email.
I'm on all the lists.
Are you on all the lists? That's funny.
You see, Joe does this so you don't have
to. That's true. That's right. So I mean, that's sort of where we're going, right? That's where we're headed into. tomorrow night.
I like that approach. It's like a spray of insults. He's corrupt. He's sleepy. He's on drugs. He's got a plant in the debate, and also the fact checkers are in his pocket. Like, he's really like covered his bases. Like, if I don't come out on top, just pick one of those
reasons,
and that's what happened here. Everybody else cheated. Oh, it's so kind of, it's very, it's so clever.
There is no gag order when it comes to debates.
Indeed.
Right. You don't have anybody shutting you up when it comes to debate prep.
I mean, I just don't think that anything can impact Trump at this point. I think this is really a high stakes event for Biden. I think he needs to show that he is on top of things. He is knowledgeable. He is not a sleepy, 80-plus-year-old man. But Trump, he can point to that whole spray of insults as to why, it didn't work out for him.
We had this discussion yesterday, and a lot of people, listeners, got mad at us when we were talking about exactly what you just mentioned. It's not that we think it should be that way. We don't believe that Biden should have to be the one working harder necessarily in this case, but it does seem to be that is what this has been built up to. I don't, by saying it, we're not saying that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it is.
But it is true.
And it's a reality.
And,
yeah.
And thank goodness he's at Camp David preparing for five days. Unlike Trump, who, according to his staff, can't be programmed by staffers.
Really?
Clearly not.
We didn't know that. Yeah.
So, I mean, and he's preparing for all kinds of types of appearances of Trump. We don't know, there's sort of this, like, the bully Trump, the shouting Trump, the Trump that actually got the shot himself to, make him more active. Because I always feel like
when he's
whenever Trump says something about somebody else and, what they're going through, half the time it's true about himself. So I'm like, what are they shooting him up with? What kind of drug to be able to walk to a seat? We always wonder about that.
I think the smartest thing that Biden's team has done is having the microphones cut off immediately after the person who is supposed to be speaking is speaking, so that he can't be heckled the whole time. I think
I can't wait to watch when they mute Trump and his mouth is still moving, looking like one of those old kung fu movies.
You might be able to hear him like shouting.
The mic is still going to pick up some of it, so it's still going to be distracting. But yes, it's certainly an improvement. I do think I said this earlier this week. I do think not having an audience is key here. I think that's a really good decision because it'll be calmer.
Do you still think he's going to do it?
You know, it's so funny you say that because every panel that we've done, so the last three after our hiatus, has had at least one, if not two or three panelists saying that they're still questioning whether this thing is even going to happen. I don't at this point. How do you get out of it? I don't know. I guess if you don't care.
The Supreme Court comes out and says that he doesn't have immunity. I bet he drops.
Which I think is why we're not getting a Supreme Court decision.
Yeah.
I mean, as of now, the last decision that came out was 18 minutes ago. So
we might not get more, you're saying?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's usually between 10 and 10:30.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to my casual reading by the pool this weekend. That's...
Yeah, exactly. To find out of the case. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
But there is this interesting, let's go back to this interesting double standard that Biden faces, where he's got to defend his record, but it doesn't seem like Trump has got to defend anything that he does. Mm. And it's also stunning to me when people say, I was better off 4 years ago than I am today. I'm like, do you remember where you were 4 years ago?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Do you remember kids in cages? Do you remember any of it?
You were being told to inject bleach.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, the way the truth, and at least the way I perceive the truth, has been so distorted by Trump and his accolades is really stunning to me. And it shows you the power of propaganda in this day and age.
Well, people believe pretty much anything their ideologue, you know, represents. And it's really quite shocking. And, you know, people wonder, they say, oh, you know, propaganda like that never works in this country. Well, it clearly does. It clearly does. You know, all you need to do is about public health issues. And this Supreme Court decision is actually kind of a bit of a joke because, you know, public health is... you know, should be controlled by the federal government because it is public health. It's the health of all of the citizens, right? And to even make a decision by the Supreme Court on the fact that the government is allowed to remove or challenge disinformation about public health issues? Are you serious? This is actually something the Supreme Court had to decide on?
The last opinion of the day for the Supreme Court is Snyder versus U.S., which deals with federal bribery law and is not among the politically charged matters the court is considering. The courts, so in other words,
except for Alito and Thomas.
Yes.
I mean,
the courts, six conservatives have found in favor of the former mayor of an Indiana city who challenged his conviction of bribery by arguing the money he was prosecuted for receiving does not violate federal law. The three liberals dissented. The Supreme Court has just wrapped up releasing decisions for the day, but they are far from finished.
Good job, guys.
More Supreme Court rulings expected on Thursday, otherwise known as tomorrow, and Friday. There are just under a dozen matters the nine justices have yet to weigh in on. But we will hear from them soon. The court has scheduled tomorrow and Friday as days to release more opinions. So that's where we stand as of.
So, do you think Clarence just earned a new RV, Joe? Do you think?
I don't know. I have some very good friends in my life, but they've given me Jack.
Well, that's because you're not making determinations that monetarily influence their lives. You don't get $500,000 vacations.
No, sending errant children to college and the like. No, not a bit. So we have just under a minute. So I think we'll be watching the debate. We'll talk about it more tomorrow night, or more tomorrow morning. We'll talk about a lot of it on Friday. But it is it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I was talking to my brother this morning in the car. He lives in North Carolina, and he said, "I don't know, Joe. I don't think I can watch it."
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel so stressed about it.
And I said, "Well, I have to, but yeah. I don't think I could miss it. I don't know.
No.
That's just like, that's a car crash. I don't think.
I do have a morbid curiosity about it.
Well, right? It's like it's like you just want to see. I mean, just the mechanics of it. I want to see how Dana Bash and Jake Tapper do. I want to see about the how this works. It is history. It's two presidents, one former, one current, on the same stage, which we've never had before. It'll be interesting to see. I think.
Maybe.
I'll just be stress eating candy the entire time.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I was thinking ice cream, but sure.
Either or. Yeah. They're both totally appropriate.
Dirt has a new flavor.
Ooh.
It's got churros.
Oh, yes. Oh, that is good.
I've been daydreaming about it for 3 days. I'm not going to lie.
It's going to be a good night on Thursday.
Yeah.
Joe, it's still geriatric politics. I mean, you think about it. It's geriatric roller derby. And, I mean...
You're waiting for an accident to happen.
There's no doubt. I mean, the two of them. And if you've seen any of, you know...
Are you advising helmets?
I'm advising
body
lots
suits.
Of things. But if you watched any of Trump's speeches lately,
it
reminds me of the scenes out of Woody Allen's Bananas. You know, with the getting up there and just sort of spewing garbage, and it's even watching his own people walk out of his so-called rallies. But then every time Biden gets up, you hold your breath, hoping that doesn't fall.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not going to be fun.
It's not going to be pretty. No.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll finish up with our group. Mm-hmm. We'll be back right after this. Mm-hmm. good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're just discussing the fact that we're still thinking and discussing the possibility if the debate doesn't take place. And I said, well, if the debate doesn't take place and we don't have any Supreme Court decisions, then we just take the day off from the show. I don't
put soothing music on.
That's right. No, there's always stuff to discuss. Always stuff to dig into.
Election results, Joe.
I'm sorry?
Family court election results.
Well, that's right. Yes. And you all have handled that beautifully, and I thank you very much. I thought initially it was crickets. It's just actually the physical dials of the radio turning off, but that's okay. All right. Let's go to, I think we have some letters. We do have letters. So let's get to those, and then we'll hone in on another topic or two. James says the problem for Biden and for the debate overall is that Trump is a liar. Trump hasn't actually done anything beneficial for America. Biden isn't debating an alternative plan for the country. He has to go head to head with a con man who's at the head of a disinformation campaign. How does one debate a liar? Does the panel have any ideas? Does anyone have any ideas?
Well, I think he's not really debating Trump so much as responding to questions fed to him by the moderators and trying to do so in a way that positions him in a stronger light than whatever comes out of Trump's mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get your message across, you know, show that you're intelligent and coherent and have, you know, a nice contrast to who's behind the other microphone. And
yeah, the word debate is fascinating to me because it's never a debate, a presidential debate, really. I mean, if you want to see a debate, look at the British Parliament. There you got debates.
I don't know that that's true. I think there's been lots of really strong debates. I just don't think that Trump debates in the traditional way. Trump is just trying to get a message to voters and his supporters, where sort of a traditional debate is responding to how other people are answering questions and trying to connect, you know, their own approach to like the question being asked. That's not the case here. But Biden has to do two things. He's got to distinguish himself from Trump, which isn't that hard. But he also has to like convince the public that his age is not and should not be front and center. And he has to highlight his successes in a way that he hasn't really been able to do. The impact of the infrastructure bill and the sheer size of the projects coming out of that bill, I think, are now starting to be seen. But he's got to connect the work that was done to pass that bill and how much success he had in that to his own personal success, which is something I think he's really struggled with.
But where Biden, I think, can come out ahead on this is that, as you know, it's sort of the crucible of dealing with the Trump tantrums. And if Trump misbehaves the way I think a lot of people expect him to, showing statesman's quality on behalf of Biden would, I think, fundamentally change the race. I think it could have a bigger impact than what we're saying. Just as it's hard to say, oh, he's, you know, Sleepy Joe and senile and all the things that are being said when we watch him deal with Trump's really, really bad behavior. I think we're going to be able to tell how poorly Trump thinks the election goes by when he drops the VP apprentice choice. That if he does poorly on Thursday night, I expect he'll drop it really quickly to try to change the news cycle away from that. So, I mean, to me, that's my litmus test of how Trump and his people think Thursday night goes.
Right. And I think and the other variable in there, of course, is the Supreme Court decision.
Absolutely.
Sort of how that figures in as well.
Which, you know, if it's as bad as I think it could potentially be, will be on next Wednesday. No, they're going to try to bury it right before the election and get into their RVs and drive out a Dodge.
Elaine says, if Trump doesn't show tomorrow, does Biden get to have the whole debate session to himself? Well, that's what they did the last time.
I mean, they're going to just have a conversation, right? They're going to ask Biden questions. He gets to explain everything. It's a calmer environment. So this could be happening. So this is why I think Trump might actually show up, because he's afraid he's going to giving a massive audience to Biden. So he will show up, I think.
I mentioned this yesterday, but he did this last time when he bailed on the debate.
Yeah.
In 2020, and then NBC offered him a forum. And
to make up for his,
and then Savannah Guthrie, who I was just infuriated, and then Savannah Guthrie did an amazing job, and I was like, oh, okay, well, this isn't so bad. But it'll be interesting to see. I don't know. I trust my fellow panelists, but I kind of think deep in my heart that this is going to happen.
Well, for somebody who sort of prides himself in this toxic sense of masculinity, that you know, his manliness is somehow tied into this.
Oh, you're talking about Trump.
I'm talking about Trump. It is. I mean, if he doesn't, it sort of paints him as, you know, as a coward.
Weak. Yeah.
And weak.
Yeah.
Des says, Vera, exactly. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. What?
Context, I believe. No, Trump always is found to be doing what he accused others of.
I think I wake up in the morning, I'm like, what drugs is Trump on? You know? Because that's what he says about others.
And I think that is it for the letters I have before me here. So let's go to our final topic of the day. And that is, okay, so we talked about Julian Assange yesterday. And unless anybody wants to really dig into Julian Assange, I would like to talk about the Apprentice movie fight.
Oh, Lord.
But
that movie is just horrible.
Okay, so is there a consensus among the panel?
You're in charge.
I know.
Lead the way.
I want happy panelists. Okay, so there's this movie, and it's called The Apprentice, and it sort of keeps us in this Trump world, which, you know, is not the best place to always be. But inside the battle to release a controversial Trump movie, The Apprentice. Now, this is a real movie. Jeremy Strong, you may remember, is the star of Succession on HBO. He also is just won a Tony Award for his work on Broadway and An Enemy of the People. And he is starring with, he plays Roy Cohn in the movie. Sebastian Stan plays Donald Trump. And this is a docudrama about Trump's years as a New York real estate mogul. It made its debut at the Cannes Film Festival last month. The BBC called Sebastian Stan, who plays a young Trump, excellent, while Rolling Stone said it was the most brutal Donald Trump biopic imaginable. So here's the problem. You may never get to see it, because a controversy was near constant for Daniel Snyder during the 24 years he owned the NFL Washington Commanders, formerly the Redskins. Now, a year after he sold his stake in the team, Snyder has landed in a different kind of dispute. His film production company, largely funded by him, is attempting to block the U.S. release of a pot-stirring movie about Donald Trump, those close to the production say. The movie, which serves as a Trump origin story, centers on his this relationship with the notorious fixer Roy Cohn, who, according to the film, taught him the political playbook that he uses to this day, which is a point that one of our panelists, Jim Ketter, brings up often. But so far, the film, which includes a rape allegation made by Ivana Trump, that she later recanted, has failed to pick up an American distributor. Even Francis Ford Coppola's eccentric epic Megalopolis, thank you, which also premiered at Cannes and is considered a tough sell for general audiences, has gotten American distribution. The holdup is notable because, judging by the rapt audience at its premiere and intense media coverage, interest in The Apprentice is high. And the timing around its release in an election year is crucial to its box office success. So, what's going on?
What's going on?
I think people just don't want to bring the wrath of the Trump empire on them the way it happened to Disney and, you know, other corporate identities. I think that's it. And it's not uncommon that movies don't get picked up. Like movies that do well in screenings or like a Sundance festival, they don't get picked up by a big producer to mass produce it or you know, sell it. But I think in this case, it's literally just the threats.
Yeah, fear and also
a defamation lawsuit. Right?
And Snyder donated to Trump's campaign. He's a supporter. Yeah. He donated in 2016 and in 2020. Mm. So, you know, it could be a combo of like fear and also like, well, I don't want to be the one that takes him down. Like, I like that guy.
The only thing worse than snorkeling in the Trump cesspool is adding Dan Snyder's affluence to it. I mean, that's kind of what we've got here.
I mean, you have to have deep pockets to take this on, you know?
I'm not sure
if it's worth it. You know, millions of
dollars?
What's the outcome?
Like, we already have a convicted felon running for president.
So
like, is this going to tip the scale
movie?
In some way that nothing else has? I don't know. It's hard to know.
Yeah, I don't quite understand. I mean, the movie, I understand if you are anti-Trump, that it would be something that you would want to see, maybe.
Maybe.
But also, you know, don't we have enough of this in our daily life?
Right.
Do we need this as our entertainment as well? That's a question. But what also I find interesting is that you can write the negative books. Those go out. That's okay. We have the latest one in talking about his time with The Apprentice, which is interesting. So negative books that are...
Well, you can self-publish your books, though. There's less there's less control over who publishes.
Put the sucker
book.
On YouTube. Go for it.
People will just watch it if they're interested.
But to me, though, it is a little bit more insidious than that, because if you look at the funding that's going into the Trump campaign, you think about the $100 million that she just dumped into it. If you look at what Schneider's dumping into it, there is a concerted effort among the uber wealthy to influence this election. That's what sort of triggered me when I was preparing for this segment.
Miriam Adelson?
That was
So the question is really, I mean, it is really an interesting question. Does it really matter still who you vote for in this country, or do outsiders or people with enormous amounts of money run the show? You know, this is a fundamental question about the kind of democracy we live in. And I think a lot of people find that equally distasteful, as you mentioned, you know? So we have people with enormous wealth deciding the future of this country. And it's in their benefit. It's not to the benefit of most people in this country, middle class and lower income level.
So stopping a movie from being distributed is sort of a microcosm of that.
It can be. It can be considered that, you know. What's the big deal, you know?
It is interesting that, like, some of the focal point of the conversation is like, oh, there's this, like, rape scene because this allegation, like... This is a man who announced publicly that he gropes, he assaults women on a regular basis and finds it entertaining. Like these are not new.
Eugene Carroll.
An actual determination, conviction. And like, these aren't new things. It would just be a visual depiction of the thing that we already know about the guy.
Selfishly, I just want to see... Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn.
And you know, sometimes, interestingly enough, sometimes a visual depiction is powerful, more powerful than
powerful.
A description or a court decision to some people, you know? Yeah, even if it's just acted out. Like, people
but
sometimes.
But that's amazing.
Make,
that's what you need. Like, that's what we need to, like, know and embrace the notion that he is
a true felon, a criminal,
a sexual predator.
Yeah.
well, I wasn't sure, but now that I saw someone do it on TV, like, now I'm sure. Like, I don't know, like, how much do you need? How much evidence of being a sexual predator do you need before
some people need more, right?
Acknowledge and admit
it's
that.
It's shocking. It's shocking, but,
and
you know?
I know this isn't going to go over well, but I don't know that we necessarily can trust French audiences in deciding what's going to sell.
Ooh, yes, yes, yes. Ooh, yes.
Now, if they were German, though.
Well, I don't know about that, but, you know, I think the French point is a good one. Who was the...
Jerry Lewis?
No, the World Bank guy who was accused of...
We're out of time. I gotta go.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yes, okay. We're stopping here.
We'll be right back after this.